Welcome to the Mind Money Spectrum podcast, where your hosts, Aaron Ogti and Trishul Patel, go beyond traditional finance questions to help you explore how to use your money to achieve the freedom you want in life.
Hi, my name is Aaron Ogti. I'm a financial advisor in the Bay Area, and I'm here with Trishul Patel, a wealth manager on the East Coast.
Hey, Aaron, great to be here today on YouTube as well. And thanks, everybody, for listening and watching.
Great to be here as well for our second video and our 119th podcast episode. Well, we probably could have chosen like a good round number to get those to line up, like start at 100 or 120 or something like that. But we're trying new things. We're experimenting. We are eating our own cooking of, you know what, let's try this out, see how it goes, get some data, and then iterate. So
yeah, it's certainly a work in progress. And yeah, why not? Why not experiment?
So as we were thinking about what we're going to talk about today, last week you mentioned the question, what if we live forever? And I think you had some things in mind, but as soon as you mentioned that, the journey I went through as a philosophy major and also as a math major, like thinking about the existential ramifications and as a financial advisor, how would you get your money to last that long? Like, I was really excited to open up this can of worms, but I think you have something completely different in mind. So today we're going to try to just talk nothing in particular, like, what if we live forever? I think that's the kind of question that we're going to look at today. So, Trishul, why don't you start off? When you first posed that question, where did it come from, and what did you have in mind?
I think this probably started more in earnest a couple years ago when I started getting into personal fitness and things like that. I think some of our listeners may recall, you know, going back towards the beginning of the pandemic when we launched this podcast, one of my personal initiatives was to get in better shape. You know, the notion was we're at home, this was during the lockdown and wasn't really moving around much, and just started thinking about what to do with, you know, extra time at home, being cooped up and stuff like that. So early on, I just started to do some running, and then it evolved into working out and doing some cardio and stretching and stuff like that. And now it's a pretty ingrained part of my life. It's something I've stuck to for the last couple of years. But along that same trajectory, I started looking into research on, okay, what makes sense in terms of creating fitness. And of course, a big part of that is becoming more healthy for today, tomorrow, and the future. And that kind of dovetails into a broader conversation on, okay, how can you preserve life expectancy, or how can you increase your life expectancy or your longevity? And how can you also increase your health expectancy, meaning over the course of your life, especially as you age, how can you maintain health in your later years? And it just got me looking into a bunch of research that, you know, we can dig into at a high level on some of these different topics. But I just started realizing there's a lot going on in this space from a research perspective, from an understanding perspective, from an innovation perspective as well. And what I started to find out is that life expectancy doesn't necessarily have a predetermined cap, you know, for an individual or for society. And then that of course leads into all these other questions, which we can of course dig into as it relates to, okay, how does one even plan for these types of things? And what impacts might this have on the individual level, the family level, the societal level, and so on? So there's certainly enough to unpack here.
I agree that there's a lot to unpack. The things that first came to mind for me were, there's a default assumption in any kind of technical financial planning of putting an end date where we need your money to last 40 years. So you work from 20 to 60, and then you need your money to last from 60 to 100. And like, you can change the life expectancy. So we can match it up with going into like 90, because that might be there's a two-thirds chance to a couple will pass away before then. You could go to 95 for a younger couple, because we have started to see some of these advancements in life expectancy and healthcare. We could go out to 100. We're just kind of getting extra conservative, where there's only like a 5% chance you'll live past that long. But there's a like just the way the math works of here's how long your money will last. We have to put some kind of end date and see, do we still have money at the end? And you start to get into like, what's a safe withdrawal rate for that long? Safe withdrawal rate research was really originally based on a 30-year time frame, going from about age 60 to age 90, along with the FIRE conversation, where now we're starting to look at what if someone wants to be financially independent at 40 and they're planning on living to age 90 or 100. So now we're looking at a 50 or 60-year time frame. So the what if you can live forever is actually almost directly applicable to this idea of we need our money to last not 30 years where we like, okay, well, we probably won't run out, but like a 60 plus year time frame. It's actually not that much harder to go, we need our money to last in perpetuity. We need our money to last kind of forever. Where the difference between a 30 year withdrawal rate, or sorry, a 60 year withdrawal rate period, and a 90 or 100 year withdrawal rate just wouldn't be that much. And so from a financial planning perspective, this is really interesting conversation. But also when it comes to talking to people about that FIRE idea, this is comes up a lot when we talked about well-being and happiness, that just getting out of your job and not working doesn't actually make you happy. It comes into what are the things you're going to be doing? How are you spending your time? The experiences, friends, family, community, how are you driving your self-worth? And that becomes, I think, an even more interesting question when you start considering what if you are 140 years old or 150 years old? What if you are as healthy at 100 as most people are at 60 right now? And that's what I am kind of really interested in discussing, where it gets into a lot of the life planning and life satisfaction of if you could live forever and we got to a point you are financially independent, how are you going to spend your time? Because I think there's real lessons and direct impact on how people are living their lives now, where almost if they were designing their life now, thinking they might live forever, I think people make different choices. I think that's okay to pursue those choices sooner instead of waiting for something at some point in the future. So I was kind of really curious. But before we get to that, like, that's almost based on the premise, what if we could live forever? But it sounds like you have some things to talk about where it's, we are probably going to live at the very least longer than we currently expect, and maybe be healthier longer than we currently expect. So before we get to the living forever, just where are we at like the living longer perspective? You're muted. Trisha, you're muted still. You muted your mic. You got to start over.
It's my first day.
It's fine. Have you seen that Simpsons episode?
Oh, boy. How many are there? 1,000 now?
I don't know. But it's long enough when I used to watch, but he becomes a submarine captain and he starts an international incident. But everyone excuses him because it's his first day and it's translated into four or five different languages.
Right. I think I recall that. He's on the deck of the ship and he does 90 degrees. And okay, so let's see. What I was basically saying is I'm certainly not an expert in what's going on in the scientific research. And I really have no idea how any of this is going to transpire. But I have noticed a few themes. You know, some of the high level themes are that there's probably not going to be one single solution that leads us to, you know, living forever, but it might be similar to like solving our energy needs, right? It's a solution by many different sources. And some of them are going to be related to, you know, figuring out why cell death happens at a certain rate. You know, we've probably heard of like the telomeres, and the way that kind of works is cells can divide a certain number of times depending on the number of cells. And each time it divides, it has this little end on the DNA known as the telomere, and it divides in half. And you divide in half enough times and the telomere has run out, and then the cell just kind of dies and stops dividing. Well, you know, there's research that suggests, for example, that there's ways to extend those telomeres. And there's some species out there that are able to move beyond the telomeres, basically stopping to divide, and they've been able to overcome that. So basically what that implies is that a lot of these things that might be driving mortality and aging and stuff like that are more programmed, not, you know, necessarily something that's just inevitable and not possible to be changed. So other things that I've seen are just research saying that life expectancy can be extended through our various other means of just being healthy from taking in, you know, better nutritional foods, healthy from maintaining exercise and stuff like that. Because even if you're extending life expectancy, you want your health to be, you know, well into those aging years. It doesn't quite help if you're living longer, but you can't actually enjoy your life longer.
Yeah.
So I think all of this kind of ties back to, okay, so now what do you do with this? There's probably going to be a transition period that's going to be pretty impactful to our lives, and even more impactful for the next generation, and more impactful for the generation after that. And that does bring into some of these planning concerns, some of these societal concerns that you highlighted a few minutes ago.
Yeah, I think one of the first things I thought about was, if we're starting to live that long, like, what's the relationship between people and their great grandkids or their great great grandkids? Like, there's a good kind of series of studies that one of the big advancements in society when it came to life expectancies was that grandparents were still around and healthy enough to teach grandkids, because the grandparents tended to be older, not able to do most of the regular functions of society. They, whether it's kind of going back to not quite hunter-gatherer stage, because it wasn't quite that long ago, but as they were kind of had built up enough experience and or, I don't say wealth, but like enough kind of community support where they didn't need to be an active contributing member to the current culture, whether it's producing, whether it's kind of food, housing, shelter, something like that. They could, but they still had the wisdom and experience that they could teach younger generations, especially grandkids. And that has been one of the better ways that society has been able to improve and kind of learn more things faster. Like, it allows the healthy adult population to be a little more productive because they have to worry about childcare just a little bit less. And by childcare, I don't necessarily mean the hours spent taking care of children, but like the teaching them how to do things part of it. It frees them up to be more productive when grandparents can be some of those teachers. And so I'm curious, like, what's the next step of that when great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents are still around to provide some of that? And what does some of those like large family dynamics start to look and feel like? Because if you have almost like one of five generations working, maybe two of five working, but you have three of the five generations in a family that don't need to be working, one is learning, one's like teaching, what are some of the implications and possibilities from that?
Yeah, it certainly can shift things in a way that can be highly disruptive to how things have gone, you know, for like thousands of years. I think one eye into these demographic shifts is happening even today. For example, one thing I look back on, for example, when it comes to just how economies are evolving, is thinking back to like Japan, right, where you have a population that is aging, and then you have a younger population that isn't reproducing. So you have an overall environment where before you had a lot of young people on the bottom, and then, you know, as a pyramid, less people middle age and less people, you know, very old and so on. And this could flip that pyramid entirely on its head. The reason that that was a concern for Japan is because if you have a large aging population that's supported by less or fewer and fewer working individuals, then it's very hard to support and grow the economy if such a small percentage of the economy is maintaining the workforce. And, you know, if that workforce is diminishing, well, then it's even harder. So, you know, what that's kind of meant economically for Japan is that it's harder for the economy to grow from a GDP perspective. Two main components of GDP are either population growth or, you know, workforce growth or productivity increases. And a large part of why global GDP has been increasing at such a tight rip over the past century or two is because of productivity growth, but also, you know, frankly, because of the population growth, which has exploded. But, you know, once that levels off and starts turning negative, well, now you're working against the tide to try to increase economic output. And that makes it a lot harder each year as more and more people fall into that retired bucket and less people are in that working bucket. But one big concern, for example, with Japan is, you know, the market capitalization of the stock market hit a high in the, what was it, like the 80s or like early 90s? Yeah. And it hasn't recovered since. That's a whole generation that's been struggling against this upward battle of shifting demographics. That's a big part of it.
I hadn't even considered the economical ramifications because, I don't know if I agree like with the idea that population could be shrinking, global population, or leveling off. Because again, I think if we're talking about the older generation living longer, I don't know if global birth rates would get below replacement level, but I do think that we'll see similar number of births as economies become more developing, some of those birth rates will come down. But if there's fewer people passing away at the older ages, I do think we'd still see population growth. But like you said, for Japan, it would be getting older. And so we have maybe, you know what, probably a shrinking workforce might be a better way to describe that. And that, I see, could have an impact on global GDP.
Right. This is where, let's see, I get to share something in real time and see if we can pull something off. I think we did this last time. Let's see. It's called presenter mode. And I just failed.
You have to click the present on the bottom, I think.
Okay, here we go. That's right.
Either present share screen or present slide right. Or video file.
Okay, here we go. Can we see that? I think so.
Yes. Yep.
Okay, so here's global population extrapolated into the future. And this is just based upon, you know, demographic changes and other various... Okay.
Now we're seeing it.
Print that. Maybe this will zoom it in. Okay, oh, here we go.
Yeah.
All right, so around when we were born, Aaron, are you an 80s kid?
Yeah, I was born in 1983.
Okay, 83. I'm 80. So roughly around, you know, 4 to 4 billion and change, something like that.
Yep.
And, you know, I think we just crossed 8 billion like last week.
Yep.
Right?
Correct.
Okay. So in 40-ish years, the global population has doubled, right? So we went from 4 to 8. In the next 40 years, it's probably not going to go from, you know, 8 to 16. In fact, you kind of see here, it's kind of leveling off by 2100. And it may not, you know, start heading downward, you know, in the 2100s even, but it's quite possible that the growth will be less exponential for sure. And perhaps even, you know, flatlining for a good period.
Okay. So so a lot of this is guessing that the growth rate was 2.1% and it's dropped to 1.06 or 8% in 2019. And so it's guessing that growth rate will continue dropping.
Yeah, to be almost negligible. I mean, again, once you extrapolate that far into the future, who knows how much error
is
in it. But basically, they're assuming growth rate will go to almost zero by 2100.
I guess I can see that. I can. So that would be talking about kind of replacement rate, or like birth rate would be right about 2%. And so actually, probably if people are living longer, so it become either birth rate gets around 2%. So it's at right replacement rate, and death rates stay more or less the same. So mortality stays more or less the same. Or mortality gets extended, people are living longer, and birth rates are getting below 2%.
Mm-hmm.
So a growth rate of barely above zero is the world is more or less, you have as many people being born as passing away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I guess I can see that.
And again, this could go in either direction. For example, if death rates start falling considerably due to longevity increasing and life expectancies increasing and things like that, well, then it could, you know, tip in one direction, versus the competing force is in a lot of developed countries, the birth rates aren't catching up with death rates, mm-hmm. meaning populations are falling because it is a lot harder to have many kids, you know, today than it was a generation or two ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think I'm going to try and really long, extended, nuanced segue, but I think it's kind of related. One of the things that came up in safe withdrawal rate research, and especially with FIRE, was at about a 3% withdrawal rate, the extension from 30 to 40 to 50 to 60 years didn't change very much. That based on all the research, a 4% was a safe withdrawal rate, assuming no changes over a 30-year time frame. If you're willing to add in some flexibility, like reducing spending in years that investments are down, you can probably get up to like a 5% withdrawal rate, or we're planning on 25 years instead of 30. Like, there's different ways to have a greater than 4% withdrawal rate that's manageable. And so for someone in their 60s, sometimes I'll recommend something like a 4.5% to 5% withdrawal rate, excluding Social Security. Once we include Social Security, then something like a 7% withdrawal rate in their 60s that drops down to 4 to 4.5% at age 70. But the idea is that 4 to 5% would be a manageable withdrawal rate for a finite time frame. For someone who's younger, say, especially younger than 50, if they want to be financially independent, we're almost dropping at a full percent. We're now at 3% would likely be safe for age 40 to 90 or 40 to 100. 4%, we have to be able to make adjustments down the road. We have to be willing to be flexible. And this is assuming over the last 100 years or so of equity and bond returns and inflation. So if we just get, again, it's not even average equity returns or average bond returns, average inflation, it's the worst case scenario over a 30 or 40 year time frame. But I have seen some research that if we look at other countries outside the U.S., that withdrawal rates could be lower. Those kind of safe withdrawal rates over 30 or 40 year time frames could be lower. And if we try and go longer and in kind of an in perpetuity idea, getting below 3% might be necessary. And it sounds like, I'm going to have to ask you to try and relate this. If the population growth is slowing and we see the world GDP starting to look more like Japan has already looked over the last 30 or 40 years, would that imply that our in perpetuity safe withdrawal rate should also be lower? And if so, do you have a guess?
So many unknowns here, but here's my optimistic view, right? So as we mentioned, growth in output, economic output, is tied to population and productivity, right? Mm-hmm. So if population diminishes, can productivity make it up? And, you know, from that perspective, I actually am a bit of an optimist, meaning, is there a bound to productivity? You know, does it have those same constraints that population does, or can productivity just continue to increase indefinitely? And, you know, but part of me likes to think that there's a good amount of runway left with productivity. And I see no feasible reason why that can't keep increasing well into the future. It's one of those things where, okay, when's Moore's Law going to break down, right? When are these different things that are exponential in nature going to finally hit a tipping point where you just can't squeeze enough juice out of them?
Yeah, yeah.
Right, so there is a possibility that productivity is able to accelerate to the point where you can have a huge aged population and you don't need to support it with a large working population. You know, the notion there is that the robots are right doing everything, right? Have you seen the Tesla robot? Or
I see it's like, okay, all the work's done by one guy, one person in one office right. Somewhere.
If you recall, like the Jetsons, right? From I was gonna say, by the way, George Jetson would be born today if that helps, or this year. But anyways, I recall his job was to, you know, to take his little space rocket to work. I don't know why he couldn't do it from home, but maybe he wanted some, you know, his own space. But anyway, he gets there, he unpacks his desk, and his job is to like click one button and then another button and then the other button back again. And that's kind of his daily chore for work, yeah, for his employment. But yeah, the notion is things could get to the point where we're so productive that you need a fraction of the population working, or you can have a large amount of the population working on a minimal basis. Like, for example, you know, we've talked about FIRE many times, you know, financial independence, retire early. But, you know, another way to think about this is financial independence, recreationally employed, right? If okay. Everybody is employed doing things that they love, they're still contributing, but it's not necessarily for, you know, doing it because they need to fill a paycheck. Mm-hmm. And things like that could provide enough push economically to keep progress going and support this aging population.
That's actually interesting. One of the things that I have been, this is starting to get a little personal, but like I've been kind of thinking about or planning, a lot of tech has had a hiring freezes. And so there's a small possibility that my wife gets laid off beginning of next year. Like there's no rumblings, there's no announcements, there's just, we kind of reading the tea leaves and we're like, just in case. And I built my business to a point where if I stop saving into my 401k, then my income can support the household if she was laid off. So we're going to be fine. And as a financial planner, I'm thinking, what happens if I stop saving in my 401k? This has been like the single biggest piece of advice that we've talked about is just saving more. And now I'm thinking, like, what if I stop saving my 401k? And one of my kind of, I don't say conclusion, but like that possibility, like what does life look like if I stop doing that for a while, is just like every other financial planning scenario over the math, where it's like, okay, if you're saving less, you have to work longer. It's like, well, okay, if I work long enough until like I'm 70 and Social Security kicks in for me and my wife, like so many things get taken care of by working longer. And we have some savings, just letting it grow. But so many things when it comes to financial independence and financial planning from that perspective are solved by working longer. You don't need to have as much of a nest egg if you have fewer years drawing it down. Mm-hmm. And it's actually a similar idea. Like, this is kind of why I started my own business, is I'm trying to create a lifestyle and an income that I can see doing in my 60s. I could actually envision, again, it's like 30 years away, so it's 20 to 30 years away. We'll say that. Since I already told you what year I was born earlier in this episode. But I can see in my 60s not being in a rush to get out of work, because I've designed my lifestyle and my work to be something that suits me on an ongoing basis, that I'd be happy to have this similar career in my 60s. And I think it's similar to what you're talking about, that like recreationally employed, where if you're going to live forever, then, and where we're making guesses on like the economic impact of a aging population on safe withdrawal rates, and maybe you can only withdraw 1 to 1.5% instead of 3 to 4%. But if you're working longer in something that you enjoy, if you are recreationally employed, that kind of solves a lot of things. It kind of solves the financial independence concern a little bit. It solves the economic growth concerns, because you aren't trying to get a 4% withdrawal rate. We're only needing 1 to 2. It solves a lot of the kind of well-being concerns of having so much of your self-worth derived from the work that you do. It maintains a pretty active community, whether it's people you work with, other people you interact with through work. It takes care of the you need to work idea, but there's a good enough research that people don't keep their minds active very well when they stop working. There's some good research that the life expectancy from when you stop working is somewhat dependent on when you stop working. Some people who can maintain a good community and try and maintain their mind active through things like crossword puzzles, but they can push off Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia, whereas those who retire and become very sedentary are much more likely to suffer Alzheimer's and dementia sooner in life. And so it gets back to that idea of living healthy. So like working longer in something that you enjoy could push a lot of these things out to be a point where they're not really a concern. Mm-hmm. And so I don't want to say that's the answer for everyone, but it wouldn't surprise me if we see over the next 50 years some kind of bigger push towards this. Mm-hmm. Where people are trying to design careers that they could do into their 60s or 70s.
Right. Yeah, I certainly agree. It brings me way back to the impetus for this business, you know, what got me thinking about how I can make this transition from, you know, being a career-oriented employee, you know, to somebody who's like retired, to somebody who's recreationally employed, right? And as I was doing my initial analysis into this area, I realized a few things, you know, as I was making the jump into, mm-hmm. you know, this transition to financial independence. I realized if wealth is managed sensibly and withdrawals are managed prudently, you can create an income stream that can support you indefinitely. Mm-hmm. In fact, that was why I named the company Investing Forever. You know, the notion is investments aren't something that just start here and end there. It's something that continues and persists. And if done well, it can have an impact over your infinite lifetime and beyond, right? So the notion with the investing side is, yeah, you're just following all the things we've mentioned to kind of be sensible on growing the wealth efficiently, right? Not being too fancy, but taking advantage of all the things. And then on the withdrawal side, there's many things one can do to extend that life of the wealth. And, you know, just as you had mentioned, there's a subtle difference that if you're planning for 30 years, again, there's caveats here, but roughly if you're planning for like a 35-year retirement, a 4% withdrawal rate is sensible. But if you're planning for an infinite retirement, a 3% withdrawal rate with caveats might be sensible, yeah. Right? And the difference between saving up for a 4% withdrawal rate versus a 3% withdrawal rate can be made up by A, either working for a couple more years, mm-hmm. or B, being recreationally employed for a good part of that period.
Yep.
And at that point, you've kind of indemnified your life, right, to financial concerns, regardless of how long you live. And that can be passed down for a generation. You know, so the vision was, what if I put forward a business that can help others do the same? And then, you know, the vision for spreading these ideas is, well, what if society did that too? What if this was the goal? Yeah. What if this is the goal of society, to make everybody on a path where they could be recreationally employed?
I've been thinking about that. It's actually just coming from Twitter yesterday. It's like, I have noticed that I have, I think, 20 to 25% of my clients who I've been pushing to leave their job. And they're not financially independent. A couple were. But it was this idea that if they can find something that they enjoy and a manager that they like working under, then so many other of the like financial concerns just go away. If they can work those few extra years where they don't have to feel so tight, a lot of the stress of day-to-day life goes away. Because a lot of people come to me like they feel stuck. Like, I make this much money, I have this much in stock options, I want to get out, but I can't. And I feel stuck. And so it's similar to the conversations of FIRE, where we're not trying to get to the financial independent part as soon as possible. We're trying to get to the recreationally employed part as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be like truly like recreationally, but like it's just there's some people who have a normal full-time job that they genuinely love their job. We go through Kinder's three questions, like, okay, your IPO happens, you have enough money to be financially independent, what are you going to do? I'll probably go work for another young startup that like excites me. It's like, okay, so you don't need to be financially independent to do that now. But there's enough people who enjoy that kind of work and they find it fulfilling that they don't need to save as much. They don't need as much. They don't need to strive for financial independence as soon as possible. I think that's probably the best way to phrase it. I don't like the feeling of striving for financial independence as soon as possible. I think that there's, it's different solutions, different ideas for different people, but most of the time, striving for financial independence as soon as possible is not the answer to whatever their problems are.
Depends on, again, this may be also semantics. For example, here's a test, right? Does somebody look forward to Mondays?
That's fair.
Right? Like, for example, I was with, you know, some friends a week or two ago, and it was Sunday, you know, evening. And then you can guess what's on people's minds. Like, oh boy, it's Sunday already, right? And the weekend's winding down and tomorrow's Monday. And you know, it kind of clicked for me that, wait, I don't mind Mondays anymore, but I used to. I really, you know, so throughout my career, I was a top performer. I did very well and I climbed the ladders and stuff like that. But I don't think I look forward to Mondays.
Yeah.
And I do now. Like I look forward to every day. So, you know, being able to construct a life, whether it means, you know, reaching financial independence or not, one part of it is having the ability to kind of regain 5/7 of your week back, right? Extending your happiness expectancy by 71%.
I have a slightly different take from that. I don't think it has to be like every day, but like I've been thinking about this idea that you should have something you look forward to doing every week. And so for me, a couple of those things are on Mondays, my wife puts kids to bed and I'll either go play softball or go see a movie. It's usually Wednesdays. I play Catan online with a couple of my friends, my dad. And so it's not even that like I'm looking forward to Monday or like or not looking forward to it, because like the work part isn't that bad. I've blocked off my Monday mornings, and that's actually a pretty nice, easy transition into the week. I still have to wake up at 7 a.m. to get kids to school on time, so I don't get to sleep in yet. But that idea, like, I actually have something I look forward to almost every day. It's like. Uh-huh. So it's like I look forward to Mondays. I look forward to Wednesday nights. I like Thursdays. I'm usually looking forward to watching football or like I'll have kids practices. Weekends are actually like more stressful just because trying to get to 3 kids sports games and just coordinating that it's a little difficult. But like that idea of having something every week that you look forward to, it doesn't have to be on Monday. Doesn't have to be that weekend idea. But I do think there's something there that I'm thinking about, like asking my clients over 2023 of like, what's something you do every week that you look forward to? I don't know, like that's a good client interaction question, but it's something that's been on my mind.
I think it could be. So I kind of heard two different things, though. Looking forward to doing something at least once a week, but it sounds like you look forward to things much more often than that.
Kind of. And it's like, and it also has nothing to do with work, though.
Maybe not, but I like it. Why not look forward to something every day?
Yeah, actually.
Like, why does it have to be once a week?
My observation is that because it's scheduled every week, again, like I miss softball games because I'm out of town, and it's like we don't make it every week, so like we're flexible. It's like low pressure, but that idea of having that weekly rhythm of something scheduled in advance really helps with that.
Right.
It's like I also say I love playing golf, but the friends I play golf with, it's really hard to find time in the four of our schedules to go play golf. So I think we played in September, and the next time we're going to play is December 18th. Like, we have to plan this months in advance. So, like, but like that weekly rhythm, I think there's something there. Because when you said, like, you look forward to Mondays, it's like, I also look forward to Mondays, but for a completely different reason. Like, I want to hear someone say, I'm looking forward to Wednesdays. Like, there's something, like, it almost doesn't matter what day of the week it is.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I'm kind of thinking that there seems to be something unique about every day that I look forward to now that wasn't there in the past. And it's kind of grown organically, right? And it's been this notion of, okay, well, you know, what can I build in next, and so on. And to add, you know, a little more description, for example, I think we talked about this, but on Mondays and Fridays, that's when I send my daughter to school. And what I end up doing on those 2 days is I drop her off to school. I mentioned it's like 45 minutes away, or like 15 minutes away, right?
This is in our fuel efficiency conversation.
Right. The notion is, she moved to a new daycare. It's further away. It's a lot less efficient to drop her, pick her up. Four round trips would take half my day. So it's not quite sensible. But if I drop her and then stay around where she is and then pick her up from there and drive back, I'm actually commuting about the same as I used to. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the compromise is what I do now is I drop her off, I go to a nearby park, and I do some work there, and then I pick her up and come back. And, you know, the reason I look forward to Mondays is I'm working from a park. Like, it's a great view. And literally, if I have a little break or whatever, or if I feel like taking half the day off, I go find a nature trail and start walking around for a couple hours. And I've been doing that for like a month or two now. And I'm like, hey, wait, I kind of like this. I look forward to Mondays and Fridays. And then, so Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursdays, I alternate with my wife or whatever. We have a cadence. So I'm at home and my wife does the droppings and picking ups. And those days I look forward to as well, because it's nice to be indoors and not have to go around, right? So I plan things that are kind of different, you know, across my week, so that there's enough variety, but such that I actually do look forward to each day.
Yeah. That's interesting. And so I like that our conversation started with the question, what if you live forever? And we've got to, what are we looking forward to tomorrow? And like, okay, what are you looking forward to on Friday? Like, and I think that's kind of the right way to go. Is if we're living forever, you don't worry about thinking in terms of decades. Like, just like, have good systems, good processes. Make sure you're saving enough, kind of thing, and or work like working well. But like, just enjoy the flow along the way. And when you get to 70 and you are dropping off and picking up grandkids 2 days a week, then like, you'll have a similar flow along the way. Like, you have that rhythm to your week.
Right. Yeah. The notion is, even if we have this very long horizon, and we already do, right? Even a 30-year retirement is a lot of time. And the notion is, okay, how are you going to maximize your happiness over that entire time? And, you know, from my perspective, it's about coming up with a cadence that feels comfortable and sustainable and enjoyable. And then, you know, all the complicated planning and math stuff, well, okay, that's taken care of, right? With either, right? So that's not part of the equation so much anymore. It's handled.
And that's a really good point, that like, because we're both financial advisors, like, getting those savings and investing fundamentals taken care of to a point where we don't even think about it allows us to focus on those, okay, what am I doing on Thursdays kind of idea. Mm-hmm. So there's definitely some kind of, I don't want to say financial freedom, because it's not a financial dependence concern. Although for you, you're there, but for me, it's like I know I'm saving enough, or at least my investments that I've have already saved over the last 20 years will grow to be enough when I'm in my late 60s. Mm-hmm. So having those fundamentals in place is a pretty strong basis and foundation for being able to take these next steps of conversations.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think it can be changing from the perspective of moving from the old paradigm of you get your education, you work really hard, you have a career, you build it up, you build up a family, you retire, and you hope you get to enjoy, that yeah. tail end of the segment, versus a different paradigm of, okay, let's build up skills so that we come up with a lifestyle that we feel like can sustain us when we're young, middle, and old.
Yeah. So I do think like it almost gets back to some of those lessons from our FIRE conversation. Like, it's actually the strong savings habit. Like, you need to, in your 20s and 30s when you're working, whether you live to 90 or 150, you need to have good savings habits during those working careers. Mm-hmm. But like that, finding that balance between saving well and working someplace that you enjoy. Like I think that building that skill set, but like having those savings habits up front is still very important.
Mm-hmm. Right. I know we're getting close to the hour. So I also wanted to share, just some things on the planning side that people can think about to make that transition easier or extend the lifespan of their decumulation phase. As we mentioned, that there were some concerns. For example, you can stick with the simple model of a 4% withdrawal, inflation adjusted, right? And that should be okay based upon history. Or if you have a very long horizon, a 3% withdrawal based on history, again, it is suggesting that should suffice indefinitely. Yeah. However, there's a lot that can be done in the middle. You know, that's why beyond just what you can put on a napkin, you can come up with strategies that can be quite helpful here. Something we talked about way back was the notion of the spending smile, right? The idea that you don't need to stick with a constant inflation-adjusted spending yeah. rate for your entire retirement period. In fact, most people, they may want to spend more when they just retire or reach that recreational employment phase of their life. Mm-hmm. And then as they get older, they may drop off their spending as they become less mobile and want to cluster around family. And, when you're currently in your 80s or 90s, you may not want to take so many vacations and things like that. But then, also plan for the notion that as you reach your final years, spending may increase because of healthcare costs, going yeah. quite high to sustain your life. A quick example, I can show it here just to kind of visualize this, is the notion of a constant inflation adjusted number, 100,000 inflation adjusted each year is just a straight line across. Whereas an alternative is just having a number that can fall and then increase.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's one way of actually extending the amount of time that your funds can last by being more flexible.
Yeah, nimble. It's I've heard it described as go-go, slow-go, no-go years, kind of as normal spending, with that big increase at the end being from significantly increased healthcare costs, especially if there's a long-term care facility involved. But the in practice, the way I've seen it play out with clients is they don't ask for a 3% inflation adjustment every year. It's like their accounts are going up in general and their withdrawals stay flat even as inflation is increasing. And then about 5 years later, it's like, oh, things are a little tight. Can I increase my withdrawals by like 5%? And so like, or even like a 10%. And so like a 10% increase on the withdrawals 5 years later is only like a 2% inflation adjustment. And so that kind of plays out where if you don't build in automatic inflation adjustments, most people have no problem adjusting to the same withdrawal rate from 1 year to the next. They don't feel the inflation from 1 year to the next. So technically, they're taking like a they're seeing their spending decrease in real terms that first year, but they don't feel any difference. And you build that up over a few years until like, okay, things feel tight. Can I withdraw a bit more? And that tends to coincide with increased returns on their investments. So that's where I see it in practice of most people don't take a 1 to 2 to 10% inflation adjustment each year, depending on what inflation is each year.
Yeah, for sure. And again, this is where some of the more nuanced forms of planning can be helpful. Yeah. As you mentioned, there is a notion that I found can make a pretty big difference. And it's highlighting kind of what you mentioned. The idea is if you're nimble, you can adjust your withdrawal rate based upon actually what's going on.
Yeah.
If the markets have done well, then you can increase spending. And if they've done less well, you can reduce spending opportunistically for a bit. You can stave off that new car purchase for a year or two, or you can take a smaller vacation this year and so on. And these types of changes can actually have a pretty substantial impact over time.
Yeah. So I think like sounds like one of our like conclusions is if we live forever, you should design a lifestyle that you can implement now, which you would enjoy even if you didn't live forever.
Right. Yeah. As you were saying that, I was thinking, okay, just take out the if you live forever for part and you're good to go.
Kind of, yeah. Just like, how do you want to live now? And then just keep doing that.
Right.
So. Well, it's a good conversation. I like this. It's a lot of fun. I'm curious where our next conversation will go.
Yeah, good stuff, Aaron. And thanks everybody for listening and watching. And if you have any comments or feedback, so we would love to hear them. You can leave a comment on the video, or you can leave a comment on the podcast itself. And do like, share, and subscribe. Thanks everybody for listening.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
We appreciate you joining us today for this episode of the Mind Money Spectrum podcast. Be sure to visit mindmoneyspectrum.com to access the entire library of episodes. Remember, it's not black and white, but the wide spectrum of gray area where you get to pursue the freedoms you want in life. Opinions voiced in this material are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. All performance referenced is historical as no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged and may not be invested in directly. Have a nice day.